Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Arthur Spitzer, legal director of the ACLU's Washington office, who assesses a recent court ruling upholding a Justice Department order keeping secret the names of immigrant detainees. Burke Stansberry of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, who discusses his group's campaign opposing U.S. intervention in El Salvador's upcoming presidential election. And Kurt Davies, research director with Greenpeace USA, who takes a look at press reports which disclosed that, under White House pressure, the Environmental Protection Agency had deleted important portions of a report on global warming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Transportation Security Administration, the federal agency created after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, is looking for more efficient methods of screening passengers through a new high-tech computer database. The aim of CAPS-2, the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system, is to assign each passenger a risk profile. It promises easy access to innocent passengers, but the system's reliance on a huge new database on all airline passengers is raising protests from civil liberties advocates. In February, the TSA granted a $13 million contract to Lockheed Martin Company to build a new computer system that links the reservation information of all the major airlines. According to the news magazine In These Times, the computer would check several government databases to give the passenger a risk score. High-risk passengers will be questioned by law enforcement and face formal interrogation before they can board a plane. Groups like the American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Privacy Information Center fear the new computer system will be used to target political dissidents. In April, the ACLU of Northern California filed a suit on behalf of Jan Adams and Rebecca Gordon, publishers of War Times. At the San Francisco airport, they were put on the no-fly list and were questioned by police. Afterwards, the duo had an S stamped on their boarding passes, forcing them to go through a second screening before they could board a cross-country TWA flight. As Gordon stated, this kind of harassment of people does not make any of us safer. For 8 years, Dallas billionaire and Republican Party donor Harold Simmons has tried to gain approval to run a radioactive waste dump in the state of Texas. In his determined effort, Simmons has hired 16 lobbyists and is relying on his deep ties to Texas Republicans and over $900,000 in contributions to Republican campaigns to push the legislation through. According to Mother Jones magazine, one of Simmons' companies, NL Industries, once hired Interior Secretary Gail Norton as a lobbyist to help the firm counter lawsuits on lead poisoning. The Texas bill would allow another Simmons company, Waste Control Specialists, to import 160 million cubic feet of low-level nuclear waste, or about half of the waste that the federal government expects to generate by the year 2010. The federal government is looking for a company to buy its waste, and Simmons could pocket hundreds of millions of dollars in profit to store it in his West Texas dump site. Aaron Rogers of the Texas chapter of the Sierra Club decries the lack of security at the nuclear waste site. She explained, "They are not even required to have a chain-link fence around it. We don't think private companies should be entrusted with something this serious and potentially dangerous." When President George Bush withdrew from the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty 2 years ago, California Assemblywoman Fran Palvey was moved to take action. Palvey pushed through a bill getting the state Air Resources Board to set new standards for reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases from cars and sports utility vehicles. The new global warming initiative was embraced by the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators, with members in 40 states who have promoted similar bills in Maryland, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Hawaii. According to The Nation magazine, the caucus was founded in the mid-1990s in response to the Republican takeover of Congress and as a means of resisting the growing power of big business. However, in many states, progressives are losing ground to the corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council. The ALEC was launched by social conservatives to push bills at the state level, but the group in recent years has been influenced by oil, gas, chemical, and drug interests. Progressives lack the multi-issue focus and organization to match the corporately funded ALEC. To beef up their activities in the states, legislators are now teaming up with unions, green activists, and grassroots community organizing groups like ACORN. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In a 2-1 ruling on June 17th, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. upheld the Bush administration's right to keep secret the names of some 700 immigrants arrested by the Justice Department after the September 11th attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. The ruling, expected to be appealed, is yet another victory for the Bush administration, whose rewriting of judicial procedures has been challenged by civil liberties groups. Speaking for the White House, Attorney General John Ashcroft has cited the war against terrorism as the justification for a steady erosion of rights accorded to immigrants and citizens. Recent court decisions have affirmed the Bush administration's right to hold secret hearings, indefinitely detain and deny access to attorneys to U.S. citizens labeled enemy combatants, and declared that Afghan prisoners held at the U.S. Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba are not subject to protections embodied in U.S. constitutional law. Last month, the Justice Department's own Inspector General released a report documenting many abuses committed against immigrants held in secret detention, confirming the fears many opponents of these measures had expressed about the dangers inherent with secret imprisonment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arthur Spitzer, legal director of the ACLU's National Capital Area Office, who examines the long-term impact these series of court decisions may have on America's judicial system and civil liberties guaranteed under the Bill of Rights.
We were certainly disappointed, although not surprised, because we knew from months ago that we had the two most conservative judges on this particular Court of Appeals on our panel, along with one liberal judge. So it was really not a shock to us that the 2-1 majority bought the administration's argument that it was somehow going to be a serious blow to the war against terrorism for the government to tell us who they had arrested and were holding in detention here. It almost surely won't be the end of the line. The lawyers working on the case haven't made any final decision, but I would say it's likely that we will seek to take the case to the next step. People we were trying to identify were hundreds of people who had been rounded up, mostly in the fall of 2001, people from Middle Eastern countries and Muslims, all men as far as I know, who had been picked up at the same time as the FBI was trying to determine whether there were other Al-Qaeda cells in the United States. And in the course of that investigation, they got thousands and thousands of tips, including things that were just, you know, there are some Middle Eastern men who live in my apartment complex and they often come home late at night. Or they talk to each other in Arabic and I'm suspicious about them. Or they picked up people who just happened to be caught for a traffic violation or for some other minor offense and were taken into custody because they were Middle Eastern men. And if they discovered that such a person had a technical violation of immigration status, like they had overstayed their visa or they were here on a student visa and they were no longer a registered student, then they were detained. And even as we now know from the Inspector General's report from the Justice Department, even if it were quickly determined that the person had no connection to terrorism, they were not released. They were held in many cases for months under very extreme conditions in solitary confinement with virtually no access to their family or to a lawyer. Until the FBI got around to clearing them and deciding that it had no interest in them anymore. And the FBI, the Inspector General has told us, gave that a very low priority. They had better things to do as far as they were concerned than to check up on these people who the Attorney General was telling us were, you know, being detained because they were part of the anti-terrorism investigation. You'd think that would be a high priority. So they wound up sitting in jail for a long time before most of them were finally deported. We had filed this lawsuit in December of 2001 when these people were mostly still in detention, and we said, we have reason to think that these people have no connection to terrorism. We have reason to believe that they really haven't had access to lawyers. We have reason to believe they're being held in very onerous conditions. Secret arrests have never been part of the American judicial system. They've been part of the judicial system of totalitarian countries. And we want the government to tell us who it's arrested and who it's holding so that we can help them get lawyers if they want lawyers and so that we can help the American people know what the government is up to here. The government strongly resisted that request and tried to persuade the court that that any interference with its anti-terrorism investigation would be, you know, would be bad for national security. The trial judge agreed with us and ordered the government to release the names. But that decision was stayed, was put on hold pending the appeal, and now the Court of Appeals says essentially, when the government claims national security, the courts should defer to that assertion. The courts really have no strong independent role to play in keeping the government, forcing the government to obey the law if the government says national security would be harmed. I think that's really the gist of their decision, and of course that's a very poor decision from our point of view because we think the courts do have a very important role to play in preventing the excesses of the executive branch, which finds it very easy to say national security, especially if it knows that all it has to do is say that to avoid any oversight of its activities.
Where do you think public opinion is at vis-a-vis these erosions of civil liberties for non-citizens and citizens alike, and what is the possibility of reversing this erosion?
My sense is that the pendulum is swinging back towards common sense. I'm certainly not a public opinion researcher, and you may know the facts about this better than I do, but I certainly have the sense that people around the country and editorial pages around the country are beginning to realize that a lot of innocent people are being harmed in this anti-terrorism crusade, and that important as the crusade is, it's equally important to conduct it in a way that's A, effective, and B, minimizes the collateral damage to people in the United States and people abroad. Nobody's perfect, and of course the ACLU doesn't expect perfection from any government. But what we see in this administration is very little effort to care about the civil liberties of Americans and almost an exclusive focus on fighting terrorism without a lot of attention. You know, it's sort of a shoot first and ask questions later attitude. I think the American people are beginning to get that idea. It's very disappointing to us that the courts have not been more willing to put the brakes on because we think that's a very important part of their constitutional duty. But more and more communities around the country have begun to pass resolutions calling upon Congress to repeal the worst parts of the USA Patriot Act. And I think as that political message gets heard on Capitol Hill and heard in the newspapers, judges read the newspapers too, and maybe that will give them a little more backbone.
That was Arthur Spitzer, legal director of the ACLU's Washington office. For more information, call the ACLU at area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at www.aclu.org. During the 1980s, the U.S. government's military and economic support for repressive right-wing regimes in Central America, challenged by guerrilla movements and civil society, resulted in hundreds of thousands of mostly civilian deaths. Under terms that ended El Salvador's civil war in the early 1990s, the rebel Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front, or FMLN, became a legal political party. It is now contending for power with the conservative Arena Party, founded by the leader of El Salvador's infamous death squads and representing that country's financial elite. Arena, a staunch supporter of U.S. policy, controls the presidency. In preparation for a presidential election in March 2004, the FMLN is holding primary elections on July 27th. Against this backdrop, the U.S. is stepping up criticism of the FMLN. America's ambassador to El Salvador, Rose Likens, recently attacked FMLN positions on a number of issues and said that U.S. investment could be withdrawn from the country if an FMLN president were elected. Underscoring Washington's position, Daniel Fisk, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Hemispheric Affairs, publicly expressed his distrust in the FMLN's commitment to democracy in El Salvador. He also declared in his June 18th comments that the FMLN's discourse looks as if it were written in Havana. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Burke Stansberry, national program organizer with CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, about the growing popularity of the FMLN and subsequent threats from U.S. officials.
There's been a huge movement against privatization, especially the privatization of health care, and that's really hurt the government. And again, all these policies, privatization and free trade, are really being pushed by the U.S. government in El Salvador. So as the FMLN gains strength and as the social movement and kind of the resistance in general to those policies gain strength, I think there's a lot of concern on the part of the the U.S. diplomats and representatives in El Salvador that the FMLN could win and that we could see a real change in the model there.
Are the people in El Salvador aware of these comments? And if so, how are they reacting?
The statements have been published in all the major newspapers in El Salvador. It's pretty big news there, and it was certainly a calculated, you know, it wasn't like she was speaking off the cuff. She said very clearly that these were statements, you know, coming directly from the U.S. State Department. The latest polls have the FMLN a good 15 points ahead in the race for the presidential elections next year, despite the fact that the parties haven't picked their candidates yet. Her statements, you know, have definitely been heard by people within the party and also just everyday Salvadorans. And I think there's a lot of concern because people see it really as a direct form of intervention and kind of meddling in the actual sovereignty and political process. I mean, they're very partisan statements to say that one party is undemocratic or, you know, will threaten the economic well-being or that the economy will collapse if the FMLN comes to power. I mean, those are the kind of statements that really could influence the way a lot of people vote, especially given the amount of power, both political and economic, that the U.S. has in El Salvador. What's interesting is that she also said that she was intentionally making it as the FMLN was selecting its own candidate, because they're in the process right now of internal primaries to figure out who their candidate is, and the two candidates are pretty divided. One of them is an old leader of the guerrillas, an old commander of the guerrillas, very strong in his critique of free trade and kind of the U.S. influence economically in Latin America. His name is Shafik Handel. He's talking about, you know, pretty major changes if he is elected, and the other candidate is a more centrist candidate, more reformist candidate.
Burke Stansberry, say a little bit more about what the key differences are between the FMLN and the U.S. positions.
I think the big ones that have come up that Ambassador Likens has talked about are dollarization. The Salvadoran economy was dollarized a few years back, and the FMLN is talking about not reverting that, but at least recirculating the colon, the former currency there, to kind of bring back some control for their central reserve bank that they gave up when it was dollarized. U.S. very much opposes that. And also privatization is the big thing. A lot of the public services have already been privatized in El Salvador, and though the FMLN isn't talking about renationalizing those, it is saying that it's not going to privatize things any further, and it's going to do everything it can to regulate the already privatized industries. So that is something that the U.S. sees as, you know, very problematic. And then the Central American Free Trade Agreement is a huge priority for the Bush administration right now. And the FMLN has basically said, both in the legislature and at the executive, they oppose the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and they, if elected, they will probably pull out of the negotiations.
On what grounds would the FMLN pull out?
There's a number of reasons. I mean, for one thing, it relates to the privatization in that it would mandate access to services of U.S. corporations so that U.S. corporations could come in and buy up, you know, the healthcare system or the education system or whatever else. Also, in terms of agriculture is one of the big concerns, opening up El Salvador to cheap, subsidized U.S. imports and how that would affect farmers in El Salvador and also other sorts of imports and how that would affect small businesses. So, I mean, there's a lot of resistance to CAFTA in El Salvador from farmers, from workers, from unions, from communities. People are really against it, and the FMLN recognizes that and sees that it's not going to be a good thing for the overwhelming poor majority in El Salvador.
That was Burke Stansberry of CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. For more information on its campaign to oppose U.S. intervention in El Salvadoran politics, call CISPES at area code 212-465-8115 or visit their website at www.cispes.org. A
recently released report from the Environmental Protection Agency was the subject of much scrutiny after press reports disclosed that, under White House pressure, the agency had deleted important information on global warming. The EPA's State of the World's Environment report had originally included references to several studies which concluded that global warming, in part, is produced by pollution emitted from factories and power plants. Before the White House changes, the report had also included documentation on how global temperatures had dramatically increased over the past decade in contrast to climate change over the previous 1,000 years. Bush administration officials, however, replaced this section of the EPA report with portions of a study, partly financed by the American Petroleum Institute, which raised doubts about the origin of climate change. EPA Administrator Christy Todd Whitman, who has resigned her position effective June 27th, denied that the editing process had compromised the integrity of the report. But former and current agency staff have complained that changes demanded by the White House undermine the credibility of the EPA to accurately report on existing scientific research. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kurt Davies, research director with Greenpeace USA, who takes a critical look at this episode, indicating that a conflict of interest between the Bush administration's political supporters and energy production companies and the public interest were the origin of these actions taken to manipulate a government report.
What happened is apparently the EPA is preparing this big report, State of the Environment, wide-ranging from water quality, air quality, and everything. They wrote a draft of it months ago, gave it to the White House for review because I'm sure everything that comes out of the EPA is reviewed by the flacks at the White House. And the White House tried to rewrite the section on climate change and add elements of uncertainty that were beyond the scope of what's uncertain. The EPA scientists said, well, that's not quite right. They pushed and pulled. And in the end, the EPA scientists decided they just could not publish what the White House had written, so they pulled the whole chapter. And they actually are now publishing a report without anything on climate change, which is also outrageous, given it's the biggest environmental problem we face for this century. So it's now gotten to even more of a controversy because, you know, who pulled it? Why did the White House try to rewrite it? It's generating a nice news cycle on how scandalous this White House is, this administration is, on the subject of climate change.
What do we know about dissent within the Environmental Protection Agency? Is it coincidence that Christy Todd Whitman, the head of the EPA under George W. Bush, is leaving her office quite soon?
That's the million-dollar question. She's a good soldier, and she's not saying that, but many have speculated for a long time that she was fed up with being knocked down by the White House. You know, she built a career sort of on the quote-unquote science-driven policy, and she also had a very fairly progressive climate policy in the state of New Jersey early on, so she gets it at some level. And, you know, she won't say, I'm sure, until Bush is well out of office whether this was the straw that broke the camel's back, but there is speculation about that. But, you know, you have an EPA that obviously has some good career people embedded who are still doing their work, you know, Clinton folks or folks who have been there longer than that, who know full well what the science of climate change says and know full well what we ought to do about it. And then you've got this White House, you've got, you know, Andrew Card, you've got all the oil connections and electric utility and auto connections that are in the White House. And they're trying to make climate change, global warming, out to be a fabrication of Al Gore or something. So it's a really dynamic but mostly hidden battle going on between the agency and the White House.
One of the things that keeps on coming up from people like conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh and many others is that there's doubt about whether climate change, whether global warming is a real phenomenon that we have to address quickly as a species here on the planet Earth. Is there really any doubt in the scientific community that global warming is for real?
There's no doubt. I mean, every scientist who really studies this problem or has taken a look at the evidence that has built and the models that try to predict the future is frightened by the evidence, quite frankly, frightened by the rate of change and frightened by what is to come if we don't change our ways and stop emitting so much greenhouse gas pollution into the atmosphere. We have more scientists working on climate change globally than any single issue right now. But what they tried to insert was this element that natural variability is somehow possibly to blame for the current warming trend that we're seeing and all the impacts that we're seeing. And that's just out of the question. I mean, no responsible scientist would ever claim that. They pointed to, in fact, they tried to get in this report a study that was just published, but published in quotes, by a couple of scientists who are funded by the coal industry. They've gotten money from ExxonMobil and other oil interests. In fact, the study was basically underwritten and signed by the American Petroleum Institute, which is just outrageous, you know, that the American Petroleum Institute would be funding a study that says climate change doesn't exist. But on the other hand, it makes sense. It's like the tobacco industry in the 70s and 80s publishing studies that said tobacco doesn't cause cancer.
Kurt Davies, what's the reaction been like in Congress to this revelation, and what are the likely repercussions, if any? Have we just overdosed on outrages coming from the White House when it comes to environmental and other issues?
Well, certainly the environment is the weakest link for this White House, or amongst the weakest links, and they know they can get hurt by it in the elections, as do the Republicans in the Senate. They all know that they're weak on the environment politically. Is there enough opposition to Bush in the Senate that's willing to take him on this? I think there are a few good champions that will surface. I'm sure they'll raise a stink. They'll yell about it for a bit in the energy debate, especially that's going on right now, the energy bill, where the Bush administration and their cronies work to remove any reference to global warming. Now, if there was any policy that had more impact on global warming, it's energy policy. Our decisions on how we make energy and how we use energy predict what global warming pollution we emit. So it's part of a trend. When are we going to say enough is enough? I don't know. I hope that the public wakes up by next year and figures out what the agenda is of this White House on the environment.
That was Kurt Davies, Research Director with Greenpeace USA. Contact Greenpeace by calling area code 202-462-1177 or visit their website at www.greenpeaceusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.